From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the great alto saxophonist Jackie McLean talks about his life in music and the things he learned from Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, and Charles Mingus. Also, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz sees the Vermeer show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. Supreme Court says it will revisit the question of executing mentally retarded convicts, an issue the High Court addressed 12 years ago. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1989, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, refused to ban capital punishment for the retarded because the court said then that there was no national consensus on executing people of limited mental capacities and whether it's a violation of the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. But back then, only 2 states had laws on the books banning the death penalty for the retarded, whereas now, roughly 1/3 of the states that have the death penalty, 13 of 38, have banned such executions. And so the court has decided to revisit the question next term in the case of a North Carolina man convicted of murder, whose lawyers say he has the mental abilities of a 10-year-old. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
A judge in San Diego has postponed the arraignment for a 15-year-old boy who's accused of killing 2 schoolmates and injuring 13 others at a high school in Santee, California. The judge agreed to the delay so that attorneys for Andy Williams will have more time to challenge a California law that would require the high school freshman to be charged as an adult. Williams is accused of opening fire at the school on March 5th. Meanwhile, classes resumed today at Granite Hills High School in El Cajon, California, opened for the first time since last week's school shooting. School authorities arranged to have about 150 crisis counselors on hand to help students deal with concerns about violence. 5 people were injured last week when a student allegedly opened fire with a shotgun. Opponents of controversial family planning rules say they'll fight President Bush's effort to block a Senate debate. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
Last week, a bipartisan group of senators said they would use the Congressional Review Act to try to overturn the so-called Mexico City policy, which bars funds for international family planning groups that perform or promote abortion. President Bush reinstituted the Reagan-era policy in January. But on Friday night, the White House announced the rules would be rescinded and the policy reissued as an executive memorandum. That could prevent use of the Review Act, which Congress just used for the first time to revoke Clinton administration rules on workplace ergonomics. Opponents of the family planning rules, led by California Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer, said they're trying to see if the president's actions to evade the Review Act are legal and raise the possibility of fighting his action in court. They also vowed to force a vote using a separate bill. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 182 points, or 1.9%. It closed at 9,687 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 10 points. This is NPR News. Representatives of NATO and the European Union arrived in Macedonia today to talk about the fighting near Macedonia's border with Kosovo. Lord Robertson, the NATO Secretary General, called on the Macedonian government to show restraint now that its troops have recaptured strategic areas from the ethnic Albanian rebels. Javier Solana, the head of security for the European Union, said it's time to resolve the conflict through political action. Yesterday, Macedonian soldiers drove the rebels back from the hills overlooking Tetovo, the country's second-largest city. Local elections in Ivory Coast may push the West African nation into a political crisis. The winner appears to be a party whose leader was barred from running in earlier elections. David Hecht reports.
Alassane Ouattara has been living in exile in France, yet preliminary results of Sunday's election show that his party has won the majority of votes. He was barred from running as president in last year's elections on the grounds that he is not a full citizen of the Ivory Coast. The problem is that Ouattara is a northerner in a country dominated by southerners. The former president, Houphouet-Boigny, did bring northerners into his government. Ouattara had been his prime minister. But since his death, xenophobia has increased. Security forces have cracked down on Ouattara's supporters, even torturing and massacring some of them. There was only scattered violence in Sunday's election. Preliminary results show that the party of the current president, Laurent Gbagbo, won less than half as many votes as Ouattara's. For NPR News, I'm David Hecht.
Sales of new houses fell in February. The Commerce Department said sales of newly built houses dropped by 2.4%. That's after falling more than 5% the month before. It's the first time since 1999 that new home sales have dropped for 2 months in a row. This is NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, the alto saxophonist and composer Jackie McLean, has been one of the stars of jazz since the 50s. He started off as a Charlie Parker disciple, soon found his own voice, and emerged as one of the leaders of hard bop. In the late 50s, McLean played with the band most associated with hard bop, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. In 59, McLean signed with Blue Note Records, and over the next 8 years made 21 recordings for the label, many of which have been reissued. His mentors, along with Parker and Blakey, were Bud Powell, Thelonious Monk, and Charles Mingus. McLean became a mentor to many young players. In 1970, he founded the African American Music Department at the University of Hartford and has taught there ever since. Jazz critic Francis Davis has said about McLean, his best solos can pin back your ears with their crying intensity. McLean's latest CD, Nature Boy, is uncharacteristic in that it's an album of ballads. Let's start with the title track. Cedar Walton is at the piano. That's Jackie McLean from his latest CD, Nature Boy. Jackie McLean, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
You got your first alto saxophone at the age of 15. How did you get it?
I got it on my 15th birthday, but I had been playing a year. My godfather, Norman Cobbs, played the saxophone, and he gave me a soprano saxophone for my 14th, when I was 14. And then my mom and my stepfather bought me an alto when I was 15.
Why did they get you the alto? Did you want it? Had you asked for it?
Oh, yeah. You know, the soprano saxophone didn't excite me at all. It was straight. It was silver. It wasn't curved. It wasn't gold. And all the things that I used to like to look at when I saw someone playing the saxophone. So it was like an odd duck. I couldn't wait to get what I call a real saxophone.
You said that you really preferred the sound of a tenor saxophone, and you tried to make the alto sound like a tenor. How come you didn't get a tenor?
Well, I didn't know that much about the instruments at that particular time. All I wanted was a saxophone. My mother went out and, I guess, bought the cheapest one. The tenor cost more than an alto, so she bought me an alto. And that was good in a way because I took the alto, and even though I loved Lester Young and the tenor players, Dexter Gordon, I just tried to do the best I could on my alto to make it sound that way until I heard Charlie Parker. And when I heard Charlie Parker play the alto saxophone, that kind of settled it for me.
Were there things that other guys your age were doing that you shut out of your life so that you'd have more time to practice?
Oh, yeah. My friends were running behind Zorro and Batman, Superman, all those people. And I was running behind Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, and Dizzy Gillespie. They were my heroes.
Jackie McLean is my guest. Bud Powell was one of your friends when you were still a teenager, and you learned a lot from him. How did you meet the pianist?
Well, his brother came to my dad's record shop, and I was playing a record with Bud playing the piano on one of Charlie Parker's recordings. And he just happened to be listening to it, and I happened to tell the person that was buying the record that this was Bud Powell on the piano. And when the guy bought the record and left, he came to me and said, "That's my brother, Bud Powell." And I said, "Really?" I said, "What do you play? Do you play music?" And he said, "No." And I took a good look at him, and I said, "Sure, right. I don't believe Bud Powell's your brother." So he said he'll prove it to me. He came back that Sunday and took me around to his house where I met Bud. And it frightened me to death when Bud came into that room and sat down at the piano and started playing. I almost passed out. I mean, I was sitting in the room with this great master that I didn't believe was his brother. And from that moment on, Bud and I became friends. Of course, there was a great deal of difference in our ages. Bud is, I guess, was about 7 or 8 years older than me. But he used to let me come down to the house and bring my saxophone and play. He would play with me. And it was very helpful. It really helped me a whole lot to get myself together musically. And he did that for Sonny Rollins, too. In fact, Sonny made a recording with Bud, I think, when he was very young, maybe around 18.
So when this guy told you that he was Bud Powell's brother but that he didn't play, was that Richie Powell? Because Richie Powell eventually did play.
Yeah, it was Richie. Uh-huh. Yeah, he did. I'm the one that started him playing because Bud didn't want him to play music. And he did everything he could to keep Richard from learning how to play.
Why? Why was he opposed to it?
I have no idea. I think it was kind of to be protective of Richard, because during those days, there was a lot of things going on in clubs amongst musicians, and I guess it was kind of a protection. But at any rate, I encouraged Richard to study with somebody else, a piano player named Bob Bunyan that I knew. And Richard was another genius. I mean, he learned how to play immediately, as soon as he sat at the piano. Everything that Bob Bunyan taught him, he absorbed immediately. And so he and I began to hang out and play together, play the blues, and I got rhythm. Some very basic things that he was beginning to learn as he started to learn how to play the piano.
Good, okay.
The day that Richard came to the record shop, he was dressed in paint clothes. He had paint all over him. He had a painter's hat, coveralls, paint all over his hands, you know. And so when he said he was Bud's brother and he didn't play music, I just did not believe him. I mean, it's just young kids, that's how we are.
When Bud Powell walked into the room, did you recognize him and realize, okay, it really is Bud Powell, or was it not until he started playing that you were sure?
It wasn't until he started playing, because I had never seen him in my life. He walked in and said, "You don't believe that I'm Bud Powell?" And that guy, I couldn't answer. I just looked. And he stepped over to the piano and sat down and started to play. And, oh, boy, I knew it was him the minute he touched the piano.
Were you embarrassed or apologetic?
I was flabbergasted. I was happy and all kind. I was all mixed up. I mean, it was an incredible moment for me in my life, you know. I mean, that time that I spent with Bud was, I guess I was just 15 at the time. For the next 2 years, I was down at his house every week. I'd go down and spend the weekends. And sometimes he would play and sometimes he wouldn't. But I also got a chance to, his mom used to let me take him to his jobs, go with him and accompany him to different jobs that he had. So I was able to go with him to clubs like the Royal Roost when they used to have afternoon sessions and take Bud down and watch him play and bring him back home. Because he had just come out of the hospital. He had a lot of shock therapy, and he needed someone as a chaperone with him all the time during these years. So I was very fortunate that fate chose me to be the person to accompany this great genius. It was like going into a place with Bach or Beethoven, some real great master of music. I was very fortunate.
What kind of mental illness was he diagnosed with? Was it schizophrenia?
Well, he got beat up in Philly. The police beat him up when he was with Cootie Williams' band, and they hit him in the head with blackjack, and he was sick from that. And I don't know how what his diagnosis was, but I do know that they did electronic therapy on him,
shock treatment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when he came home, I didn't know him before he had this shock therapy. So when he would ask me, who is Sonny Stitt, or did I make a record with Charlie Parker? I mean, it was because he was trying to get his mind together. It was an incredible period in his life.
Was it difficult to communicate with him or to be friends with him because of that problem?
Not really. He was like, it was childlike sometimes. He was in a state of grace, you know. He was just music. I mean, he would sit down at the piano and play, and it was just incredible. And then he would ask me, did he sound good? And I'd say yes. Or when he was getting dressed to go to a job, he'd ask me, do I look okay? And I said, oh, yeah, bud, you look great. Come on, let's go. I mean, it was like being with my little brother in a way, you know.
Why don't we hear a composition of Bud Powell's that you recorded in 1962 on your album Let Freedom Ring. And this is I'll Keep Loving You. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Oh, it's a beautiful ballad. Not very many people play it, and I love it. So I was very fortunate to be one of the few musicians from my period that recorded this piece.
Here it is, Jackie McLean, 1962. That's the Bud Powell composition, I'll Keep Loving You, from Jackie McLean's 1962 recording, Let Freedom Ring. Jackie McLean, what are some of the things you learned from Bud Powell? What was his approach to teaching you?
Well, you know, in a way, he kind of spoiled me because I would ask him about chord progressions and things like that, and he would say, don't worry about that, just use your ears. And he'd play chords on the piano and teach me melodies, and I'd play with him. And I did as he said. I'd use my ears. And so I was very late in really learning the theory of music. By the time I started playing with musicians like Miles Davis, I had to really turn around and start to do a serious study on chord progressions and such, because I was a little behind just playing by ear.
My guest is alto saxophonist and composer Jackie McLean. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is alto saxophonist and composer Jackie McLean. He's been one of the stars of jazz since the late 50s. Your first record date when you were 19 was with Miles Davis, and I'm wondering how you got the date.
Well, you don't get a date, you earn it. Bud called me to the house one day and told me, he said, listen, Miles needs an alto player. I want you to go down and sit in with him in Birdland, the club. So I'll never forget, it was a Monday night, so I came in from school that afternoon and practiced and headed down to Birdland, where Miles had left my name on the door. And I went in and sat in with his band, and I guess he liked the way I played, and he said, come out to my house tomorrow. And he gave me his address. I went to his house. We practiced the next day. Then I started getting a few jobs with him. And Sonny Rollins was also working in Miles's band. So we were together again in Miles's band.
What was the advice or instructions that Miles gave you for this session?
Well, one of the things that he told me, he said, you've got to learn something about the piano. You know nothing about the piano. You need to learn how to construct chords, and you got to learn how to play by chord progressions as well as by ear. And so that was very helpful to me. Miles was very encouraging to me during those years.
Do you want to choose a track from this session with Miles Davis, the Dig session, that you'd like to play?
Maybe the title track.
Sounds good.
Dig.
Let's hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Dig from the Miles Davis CD of the same name. It was the first recording session that my guest Jackie McLean was featured on back when McLean was 19 years old. Did this date change your life?
It certainly did. It frightened me to death because the day that I went into the studio to make the recording, Charlie Parker was there. He was sitting in the room with the engineers. And when I walked in and saw him sitting in there, I almost passed out because he was my idol. And I just felt like I couldn't play with him there. But he came out of the booth. He saw I was nervous and came over and talked to me and calmed me down, and I was able to do it.
Did he say anything about what he thought of your playing?
Oh, yeah. He always encouraged me to play and always told me he thought I played well. You know, a guy like Charlie Parker could destroy a young player by just saying, you don't sound good at all. You need to go home and practice, or something like that. And it could really crush somebody who looked up and admired him as much as I did. So I imagine he could see that, and he really encouraged me a lot. He did a lot for me in my early days.
Was this the first time you met Parker?
No. Oh, my goodness. I used to run around behind him like a puppy dog. We used to go downtown and wait to see him come out of the subway when he was going to work and on at the Three Deuces on 52nd Street. And we'd be standing out there from 8:30 at night waiting for him to show up. Sometimes he didn't show up until 9, 9:15. And when he'd come out of the subway, we'd fall right in step with him and talk to him all the way around to the club. And then he'd go inside just to be close to him, so that he would know us, one of my buddies.
Was he flattered? Did he mind?
Yeah, he was. I think it knocked him out, especially when he asked my friend and I if we lived in that neighborhood. And we told him, no, we came down from Harlem to see him. So he said, you guys live all the way uptown? We said, yeah. You come all the way down here? He said, yeah. And I said, I got to get going to get home now. My mother's going to kill me, because I used to have to be home before 10:30 at night. And so we'd go downtown at 8:30, see Charlie Parker, walk him to the club, stand outside the club till about 9:45, and make a mad dash for the subway so we could get home.
What would happen if you didn't get home by 10:30?
Oh, my mom would be very upset with me, you know. She would be very angry with me and say, listen, when I tell you to be in at 10:30, I don't mean 10:45 or 11. I want you in here at 10:30 or you can't go out next weekend. So she was very strict on me that way.
And would she actually have prevented you from getting out, or would you have, like, walked out the window?
Oh, no. I was an only child. I knew how to hug and kiss her and get her to let me go. Yeah.
Now, there were times when Charlie Parker had to hawk his saxophone in order to get money. to buy heroin. And he would sometimes borrow your horn for dates. And I think there were one or two times when he actually hawked your horn as well. How did you feel about giving it to him, knowing that that could happen?
Well, it was wasn't quite that simple. Charlie and I used to rent horns from off of 48th Street and 46th Street. And when he had the horn, sometimes I needed to use it, he would loan it to me. One time he came to me and he asked me to go rent the horn from the store, and I went and did that. And then he came and borrowed the horn from me and pawned it. And so I had to go back to the store and say, the horn is gone. And the man was very upset with me and, you know, was angry with me for a number of years. But eventually Charlie straightened it out.
What did he do?
I think he went by the store and paid him $300 or whatever it cost.
Would you get angry with Parker for that, or just kind of accept it as part of who he was?
I couldn't get angry with him for anything. I mean, he had those problems that he had, I didn't understand at that particular time. I never got really angry at him about anything.
Now, how did knowing him and loving his playing as much as you did change your idea of what to do on alto saxophone?
Well, it's like somebody teaching you the next step and showing you the next direction to go in. And I think that's what he did for all of us. I mean, Sonny Rollins, John Coltrane, practically all of the, I would say all of the saxophone players that came during that period. Charlie Parker was a person that pointed in the direction, and then everybody tried to develop their playing style according to what he had done prior to 1945, 46, because early on he sounded very much like Lester Young, and it was much easier to copy some of his ideas that he played when he was working with Jay McShann. But from around 1945 on, his playing became so intricate and technical that very few young saxophone players could copy his stuff.
Jackie McLean will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at SaabUSA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jackie McLean talks about Charles Mingus, the civil rights movement, and teaching. And our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, goes to the Vermeer Show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with alto saxophonist and composer Jackie McLean. After playing with Miles Davis, Charles Mingus, and Art Blakey, McLean became one of the leaders of the kind of jazz known as hard bop. In addition to performing and recording, he's been teaching at the University of Hartford for over 20 years. Before we talk with him about playing with Mingus, let's hear McLean's solo on Mingus's composition, My Jelly Roll Soul, from the 1959 Mingus recording Blues and Roots. Jackie McLean with the Charles Mingus Band in 1959. I asked McLean what he learned from playing with Mingus.
He was determined for me to have my own voice. He used to really get upset if I quoted any of Charlie Parker's ideas in my solos. He would come to me after I maybe would have played a line that Charlie Parker played on a record, and he'd come to me and say, Jackie, when are you going to stop doing that? You've got your own sound. Play your own ideas, please. You know, he used to say that to me all the time. And it helped me a great deal. I mean, I still quote Charlie Parker sometime when I'm performing in a club or somewhere in a concert because it's like part of the language. But I understood where Charlie was coming from. He was really determined for me to get my own sound and my own style.
Did he say that in a nice way or was he belligerent?
That's good. That was a good question. Sometimes he would be mad, be angry. Other times he would be sweet. Charlie was a very complicated man, very difficult person sometimes to perform with, but a great genius of the music.
And how did you take the criticism? Did you think, oh, it's nice to be criticized, it will help me grow, or were you initially pretty upset or mad that you were
being criticized? I never got mad at Charlie for that because I knew at the time that he had had the experience. He'd worked with all the great musicians, and he was a great genius himself, and his compositions were great. I enjoyed playing them. And so, you know, I listened to him like a big brother and took his counsel to heart.
Do you think that part of the reason why his records are so great and why musicians tend to sound so terrific when they played with him was that he would push them hard?
Yeah, he was always looking for the new ground and always looking for a new feeling, a new sound. At the same time, he always liked to maintain the blues and the roots of the music. And so you got all of that with Charlie. You got the roots of the music from the gospel and the blues, and you got the freedom to go out and experiment with new and fresher sounds playing with Charlie. I also learned a great deal from Art Blakey, the years that I spent in the Jazz Messengers. That was some of my happiest years in a band. And Art Blakey was a great leader, and I learned so much from him.
Now, temperament-wise, he strikes me as the opposite of the really mercurial and sometimes violent-tempered Charles Mingus. Blakey just seemed like he was just such a nice guy.
Yeah, he was a rough guy too, though.
Was he?
He was tough, Art Blakey, but he was the big brother. He was like my big brother. That's the best way I can say. And I learned so much from him about how to lead a band, and how to keep a band, and how to deal with other musicians in this business.
But like and, what?
I learned how to keep a band rehearsed. I learned how to talk to an audience from the stage because I had never opened my mouth on a microphone before I went with Art Blakey's band. And all of these things that weren't important to me early on suddenly became important. You know, he used to say, look, man, one of these days you're going to have your own band, and you've got to go to the microphone and say something to your audience. So I want you to, tonight, when we finish the first set, I want you to go to the microphone and he used to say, turn us off. And so I'd go to the mic and announce everybody's name and have the audience applaud for Art Blakey and leave the stage.
Were you mic shy?
Yeah, of course. I think most musicians that never talk into a microphone, that only play instruments in a mic, are mic shy in the beginning. I know I was. I didn't think I would have, you know, I was nervous. I didn't want to go to a mic and talk to an audience. But Art forced us to, you know. Every night he'd send a different person to the mic.
Now, when you say that he was tough, what do you mean?
Well, because, I mean, he conducted his band like almost like a unit, an army. You know, we had uniforms, and he had rehearsals set for a particular time, and we traveled in two cars on the road. I rode with Art, and the other guys rode in the other car, and we traveled from city to city. And he was a great leader, strong leader, and somebody that I really admired and loved all my life.
What did you get to be in the car with him?
I guess just because I was perhaps maybe the oldest one after Art in the band. The other guys were younger than me. So the three guys, Spanky DeBress, Sam Dockery, and Bill Hartman, rode in the big Fleetwood Cadillac. And I rode in the Sedan DeVille with Art. We had two Cadillacs we traveled in.
My guest is alto saxophonist and composer Jackie McLean. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is alto saxophonist and composer Jackie McLean. He's been one of the stars of jazz since the late 50s. When you called your 1962 album Let Freedom Ring, I figure you had two meanings there. One might have had to do with free jazz and the freedom in the music, and the other having to do with the civil rights movement.
That's exactly right, because I was performing in Washington when Martin Luther King did his speech there at the Lincoln Memorial, and I was leaving town that day to go back to New York after a week in Washington, and I recorded that album a few days later, and I was still very moved by what Martin Luther King had to say that day and what I thought it would bring to America.
How involved did you get with the civil rights movement? And I'm also wondering how that affected your sense of yourself as a composer and musician.
I was very involved in it. I did a lot of raising money for the Black Panthers and for SNCC. And when they had the riots in Jersey, I took my band and went over there and performed all day to raise money to get the people that were locked up in jail for rioting out on bail. So I was very close to the movement. But I raised a lot of money for the Panthers all over the East Coast.
Do you feel like your music took on a political tinge to it during that period?
Yeah, most musicians always have some kind of hidden agenda for things to be better. When Charlie Parker recorded Now's the Time, he meant that now's the time for things to change for people. That's just what that meant. And there is a lot of history in that music, and a lot of politics in the music that was performed during those years.
Jackie McLean is my guest. Let's hear a track from Let Freedom Ring, and this is your composition, Melody for Melanie. Do you want to say anything about it?
Oh, that's my daughter, Melanie, and we were supposed to be a quintet that day, but the trumpet player got sick and couldn't make the recording, so we recorded as a quartet. And it just happened, you know. I had that piece that I had worked on, Melody for Melanie, and we just stretched it out and and played it twice as long because we lost one of our members.
Well, it's 13 minutes and 20 seconds.
Yes, very long, yeah.
Well, let's hear an excerpt of it. And this is
okay.
Jackie McLean recorded in 1962. Alto saxophonist Jackie McLean from his 1962 recording Let Freedom Ring. The drummer on this recording is Billy Higgins. I understand Billy Higgins has been very sick.
Yeah, there goes my heart. That's a guy that is one of my favorite drummers of all time. He's an incredibly talented musician, and yeah, Billy has been sick. But he's doing better these days. He's recuperating out in Los Angeles as we speak, and still playing very well. We just played together a year ago in the Vanguard, and he was as strong and as beautiful as ever. So I pray every day for him to get better and get strong again.
Did you have a kidney transplant?
Yeah, liver.
Liver transplant. Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, that was a rough one.
Now, what makes his drumming so special for you?
His concept of time and his talent for listening. I mean, he's a marvelous accompanist. He hears everything a musician plays and responds to it quietly without being overbearing or getting in the way. And he's got a beat that is just the happiest thing on earth. You know, his beat is just incredibly marvelous. I mean, I can be depressed and feel like the weight of the world is on my shoulders. And once I step up on the stage with Billy Higgins and look back there and see him playing, I'm in good shape because he's got such a marvelous feel.
What happens when you're playing with a drummer who isn't very good?
I don't play with them too often.
I guess that's true, yeah.
Yeah, I don't get it. I mean, I've been very fortunate. I have played with some of the greatest drummers that have picked up sticks, you know, from Art Blakey, Tony Williams, Max Roach, Jack DeJohnette, all the marvels, Billy Higgins, of course. And I've been very fortunate to have performed with the great, great drummers. Michael Carvin, one of my favorites.
Now, I think it was in 1970 that you started teaching, and you founded the Department of African American Music at the University of Hartford. Why did you start teaching?
Well, it just happened. Some students came to a club. I was working in New York, a club called Slugs on the Lower East Side, and asked me to come up to the school to look at their program, and that they wanted someone to teach some courses in African American music and history. So I went up and met with the students, and it just happened. I started commuting to Hartford in 1968, one day a week, and one day led to 2 days a week, and it just slowly developed. Max Roach and Archie Shepp were some of the first guys that went into the schools to start to develop programs, and I followed in 1970, and built my department from scratch, and had Jackie Byatt up there with me and Paul Jeffrey. And I had many, many master classes there with Dexter Gordon and some of the fine Duke Jordan, some of the finest musicians in the business. And so it's a wonderful program at the Hart School of Music. And just recently, last November, they've changed the name of the department. Now it's called the Jackie McLean Institute of Jazz.
Oh, no, really?
And it's running very well.
When you were 19, your idea of being tested was to see if Charlie Parker thought that your playing on a Miles Davis session was decent. What kind of testing did you do for your students? Did you, you know, what did you think of testing and grading in music?
Well, I don't approach it that way. What I do is when I hear a young musician in my program playing really great, I pull him aside and say, bring your instrument down to the Village Vanguard next week and play with me. And that is a plus and an A for him. He comes down, gets a chance to get up on the bandstand with me and my group and perform, and it's a very positive move for most students. So I've used my bandstand as a means of rewarding very talented young musicians.
Do you feel like your playing is still changing?
Well, I hope so. I practice every day, and that's my whole purpose, to practice, to work on things that that I'm not doing musically, and work on things that I'm trying to accomplish musically. So, sure. I spend some time at the piano practicing compositions written by great musicians. This morning I was playing some Thelonious Monk things on the piano, some Mal Waldron things, beautiful songs that these people have written. And before I came to the studio today, I practiced for an hour on the saxophone. So I still work at it every day.
So when did you learn to play piano? You mentioned that when you were 19, Miles Davis suggested that you needed to understand the piano and understand chords on the piano, but you didn't own one, so you couldn't really do that.
Yeah, it really started in 1967, almost 9 years after Miles told me to get started. I finally got a piano and started to work out chord progressions and to learn to play. And so I'm very happy that I did that, because it's very enjoyable.
In what way is it helpful?
Well, because you can see how a musician like Thelonious Monk constructs a melody, or how he puts his chords together to get particular colors that he gets out of the instrument. And it's his palette is broad, you know. I mean, some of the colors that he gets out of, the sounds he gets out of the chords are dark, and some of them are old as ragtime and have a beautiful tinge to them. And yet and still, some of the other things that Thelonious plays are like somebody throwing water on you, you know, it splashes off of you. So it's interesting to sit down and analyze musicians, what they've written, and to try to play it on the piano yourself. You learn a lot.
And I imagine it's good to be able to actually see how chords are laid out on the piano, which is something you can't do on a saxophone.
That's right. That is correct.
You actually wrote a book of, I think, practice exercises for saxophonists. What kind of warm-up or daily practice do you do?
Just what's in that book. First, I start out with playing long tones to try to develop my muscles in my mouth, the embouchure. And then I play through a series of scales and chords just to get my fingers limbered up. And I put it all in that book. It's called the Jackie McLean Warm-Up, and it's really what I've trained all my saxophone players with, you know, playing scales and chords chromatically so that you're covering every key of the 12 keys.
Do you have a good memory?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, I think it's really important when you're playing in a lot of different keys, no?
Oh, you know, it's very important. You know, one of the things that I think is most important is, oh, I forgot. Yeah, I have a good memory. I just had to say that.
Well, thank you for being so corny.
Thank you for accepting that.
Jackie McLean, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry. It's been great. I had a wonderful time talking to you.
Let's hear a track from Jackie McLean's latest CD, Nature Boy. This is Smoke It's in Your Eyes. Coming up, our classical music critic Lord Schwartz goes to an exhibit of paintings by Vermeer. This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is a passionate admirer of the 17th century Dutch painter Vermeer, who died at 43 and left a small output of understated masterpieces. Lloyd went to the Vermeer exhibit at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art and has these thoughts.
5 years ago, I went to the National Gallery in Washington to cover the very first art exhibit devoted entirely to Vermeer. Fat chance, I said, an exhibit like that would ever happen again. But now the Met has a show that includes nearly half of Vermeer's 34 known paintings, and nearly 150 other paintings and objects created in the city of Delft, where Vermeer lived and died. Vermeer is one of the quietest painters in Western art. Most of his paintings are small, but even the large ones often depict the very act of contemplation. A woman opening a window. A woman holding up a scale in front of a huge painting of the Last Judgment on the wall behind her. Martha and Mary contemplating the visitor to their house, Jesus. An artist concentrating on his model as he begins to paint her. The model contemplating her own role in this enterprise. If you love Vermeer, though, you're in a bind. No reproduction has ever captured the uncanny quality of his light. But you could travel far and wide and still not see all the paintings you care about. I've tried. So you have to be grateful for the blockbuster shows that gather numerous works in one location. But how can you contemplate the contemplative while you're elbowing your way through a crowd, jockeying to get into the first row of viewers, or hearing dozens of rented audio guides chirping around you like so many crickets? There's no satisfactory answer. Is it better at least to try to see the paintings and then think about them later? I guess that's what I did some 15 years ago when I wrote a series of poems about some of my favorite Vermeers. To celebrate the new exhibit, I'd like to read a poem about one of the Vermeers in the show, the woman holding a balance, who seems to be weighing her soul against the value of life in this world. Woman holding a balance. What is she weighing? Gold in burnished piles, scattered pearls, against the resurrection and the life? Or is this, as the legend says, only a test to divine the sex of her unborn child? Light edges in from behind the curtains, over her face, her fingers from which the delicate scales depend. On the wall behind her, the Last Judgment looms, the hysterical world of the spirit. She balances herself, touching the edge of the table before her. The shadowy things of this world reach toward her hand. Next to the covered window, a sliver of mirror. If she looked up, she could see what is there to see. Her face, the gold, the pearls, the light. The resurrection and the life. Vermeer himself seems more aware than most artists about the paradoxical way the spirit inhabits the everyday world. Would he be astonished at the crowds gathering around his modest but dazzling images? Would he sympathize with the viewer who is trying to connect with the spirit within these paintings, while it's practically the intention of the world around to make that union as difficult as possible?
Lord Schwartz directs the creative writing program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed the exhibition Vermeer and the Delft School at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York through May 27th. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Wisdom of Menopause, Creating Physical and Emotional Health and Healing During the Change by Dr. Christiane Northrup. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Jared Harris. He played Andy Warhol in I Shot Andy Warhol. He was the Russian cab driver in Happiness, and he played John Lennon in the VH1 movie Two of Us. Jared Harris stars in the new independent film Shadow Magic. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.